spent a great deal of time in the movement and with SCLC. So I'm going to pass the mic to Smiley to get the start.
Well, good morning. I went on staff with SCLC in 1965, and that was right after the Selma Montgomery March. And there, I ended up going to Atlanta from Selma, and I went up to London first for the scope training. And I went back to Selma, and then I went to Mississippi for the Meriden March. Then I ended up in a little county, a city called Dawson, Georgia, Terry County, Georgia. And that's where we did voter registration. I used to do a lot of traveling with Jose. He used to travel around and show me the ropes. So he sort of adopted me as his son because I was young, and he sort of wanted to keep his hands on me and make sure I go in the right direction. But as I remember when the voting bill passed in Selma, that the challenge was to go out and get people registered to vote. There was two challenges that you had to persuade people that that was the right thing to do. Then the other challenge was that the white community opposed that. Some of you guys hear the story that Arkansas always tell, that we was out on some plantation, some dark road, and the sheriff saw us walking with this black young lady, and they saw Arkansas, and they went and turned the car around. Arkansas and I had to hide in some bushes. We couldn't come out on the main road. We had to go through the swamps. And we had to stay in there till dark, till someone came from Selma to pick us up. So it was a challenging experience. I remember that in Dawson, some of the young ladies, Evelyn Williams and Pat Lancaster, I don't know whether you know those names, and Jackie Smith got ran out of town. And so the FBI, they filed a report with the FBI, and they did some investigation. Then I ended up going to high school, and I completed high school in California. So one day the FBI called me and said they want to interview me. And one of the questions I asked, I said, we've been trying to get a 66 voting bill through for the longest. The 66 voting bill, whether you know about it, was to protect civil rights workers to go out and register to vote, because it was very dangerous. And I remember this FBI officer told me, he said, well, there wasn't no bloodshed. And I thought about what he said, that every accomplishment that we made in the movement, there was some bloodshed. You know, we talked about the four little girls in Birmingham. We talk about Jimmy Lee Jackson, Reverend Reed, Jonathan Daniels. There was some blood shed in almost all those bills. So he said that's why the bill died. I don't know what else I'm supposed to add to this, but I'm going to turn it over to Bruce.
All right. Is this working?
No.
Well, good morning again. The title of this event uses the word legacy, and that's what I want to talk about, is what is our legacy. In 1963, I started working with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. 1963, legacy, right? Okay. So 63 and 64, I was with CORE. And then early in 65, I came to Selma and started working with SCLC. I worked then through the Selma campaign, then Crenshaw County during SCOPE, Hale County later on, the Meredith March, and then 9 months in Grenada, Mississippi, which is a movement that has never actually gotten the attention that it's due. It's one of the longest and hardest fought campaigns of any locale in the South. And today, as you know, I'm web spinner for the Civil Rights Movement Veterans website. Let me just say right off the bat that as far as I'm concerned, SCOPE was a significant and integral part of the Southern Freedom Movement. And because it was an integral part of the Southern Freedom Movement, I'm unable to separate out my SCOPE experiences from my experiences in the whole freedom movement. So I'm going to talk from the freedom movement, not one particular a legacy.
We got up here. I'm going to let you switch on this one up here.
Oh, okay. Apparently I'm talking about the wrong thing. I'm sorry. Well, as a SCLC staff member, I want to talk about what I learned, because, now I'm going to go ahead and talk about it. We are the legacy. What we learn is the legacy. And in light of today's current events, I want to mention just four of the things that I learned as an SCLC staff member, and that SCOPE and SCLC leaders taught me. And the first thing I learned is the centrality of nonviolence. Tactical, nonviolent, direct action is how change has been forced up from below in this country for the past 100 years. If you look at all of the movements of the past 100 years, women's suffrage, labor movement, environment movement, civil rights movement, all of them, the ones that have succeeded by using nonviolence. They may not have used the term, but they used the strategy and tactics. Now, back in the day, you all remember, there was a lot of discussion over self-defense. Self-defense against the Klan terrorism. For me, that's a separate issue. People with guns, when I was on the SCLC staff, people with guns guarded my life. They guarded it all night while I slept. And I had no problem whatsoever with that then or now. But that was not social change. That was defense against terrorism. Social change was won through nonviolent strategies and tactics. And those tactics have to be explicitly and frequently proclaimed and adhered to. Looking at what's happening today from my experience as an SCLC organizer, I am absolutely convinced that the hooliganism and graffiti spraying and window smashing and trash fire setting and provoking and taunting of the police that we see sometimes, certainly in my area around Oakland, California, is self-defeating. So for me, one of the legacies and lessons of SCLC is nonviolence. The second lesson is the necessity of leadership and discipline. Leadership exists anytime two or more people are doing anything, whether it's deciding where to go to dinner or deciding to overthrow the state of Alabama's racist segregation, there is leadership. Somebody is taking the leadership. But if it's hidden, if people are saying, oh, we're all leaders here, there ain't no leadership here, we're all equal, then what that means is that the real leadership is hidden, and it's covert, and it cannot be held accountable. SCLC did not fall into that nonsense trap. Jose Williams, Dr. King, Andy Young, Bevel, Septima Clark, Dorothy Cotton, we recognized them as leaders, and we held them accountable. And that was, and that leadership was what allowed us to make to win victories. So, what a lesson I learned is that you cannot build an effective movement without leadership and discipline. And by discipline, I don't mean somebody, you do this, oh, you did that, I'm going to punish you. I mean self-discipline and commitment, as opposed to everybody do your own thing. When everybody does their own thing, nothing happens except confusion, chaos, and the people who are and people not being held accountable for what their action is. An essential part of leadership and discipline, in my opinion, from what I learned in SCLC, is democracy. The concept that I'm with a group, we're trying to do something, we argued something, I lost the vote, so I'm going to carry out what the group decided, even though I didn't agree with it. That is part of the discipline and leadership that leads to actual social change. The third thing, the third lesson is mass support. Margaret Mead, the famous, I guess she was an anthropologist, she said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. What SCLC taught me is that, those small groups only achieve real social change when they win mass support. We all remember the courageous few in our counties who dared defy the sheriff by attending meetings, going down to the courthouse to register to vote, allowing a white person like me to live in their home, and guarding my life while I did it. But they were the few. We may remember how many people were afraid even to talk with us. In some counties that I worked, not a single church was willing to open its doors for a mass meeting at first. But the training and leadership we received from SCLC taught us how to help the local leaders, who were the real leaders, how to help them build broad mass support within their community. Most of that mass support was not overtly active. That is, they didn't attend meetings, they didn't go on marches, but without their political support, we would not have won anything. And what I learned from people like Hosea and Bevel and Septima Clark is that as organizers, helping building that support was not about the brilliance of my ideas. It was not about the sophistication of my analysis. It was not about my ability to argue a vote in a meeting. It was about the integrity of our character, our respect for others, our willingness to listen and learn, our determination to speak truth to power, and our courage in the face of danger. The last thing I want to talk about that I learned in the freedom movement is audacity. From childhood, our society trains us to always ask permission from authority for every act and action. Parents, cops, administrators, teachers, lawyers, we always are trained to ask for permission. And we're also trained to seek permission from our peers, from our friends. We don't want to do anything if they're gonna sneer at us or laugh at us or, oh, what are you doing? So we as a society are trained to ask for permission. The problem is no one is ever given permission to rebel. It's a contradiction in terms. So freedom movements don't ask for permission. Freedom movements assert freedom. What the freedom movement taught me is that you don't ask for your rights. You assert them. And if necessary, nonviolently, you pay the consequences.
Thanks, Bruce. I want to, in terms of talking about the leadership of SCLC, but from the beginning, I want to focus on one area. Because a number of you yesterday said I hadn't heard about the Meredith March. And I just want to take a few minutes to talk about that. Jane Meredith, who integrated Ole Miss, protected by the U.S. Marshals, after Swan and Goodman and Church Goodman across Mississippi, Meredith decided that I'm going to walk across Mississippi as a way of saying to black folks not to be afraid. He started off on the first day Meredith was shot. And most of the civil rights organizations responded to Meredith being shot. And Dr. King was one of those leaders who decided that SCLC was going to Mississippi and pick up where Meredith was shot. I was working in Greene County at that time. So I was one of the first to arrive in Mississippi because Greene County is not that far from the Mississippi line. So that's what essentially what the Meredith March was about, was to stand up to the fear of the Klan and saying we're not going to stand silent while our churches are burning. The Meredith March also meant a change in the movement. You had Dr. King, Stokely Carmichael, Jane Fung, John Lewis, all of those leaders was on the Meredith March. The conflict began on the march. Stokely Carmichael and Willie Ritz used the phrase black power. And that began the change in the movement. Dr. King didn't want to use that phrase and was opposed to that phrase. And to be honest with you, there had been conflict between LCLC and SMNT. One of the issues for SMNT was that you had all these ministers and you had LCLC staff being paid $50, where they weren't being paid. And Smith felt that LCLC leadership took the South places to go. And in Dallas County, SNCC had went into Lowndes County, Alabama, which is just beyond below Selma. And LCLC went to Selma. And so the SNCC said, though, that that wasn't right. So that was a, sort of the beginning of the conflict and change. Because SCLC was still relying upon Bruce and you. And SNCC was beginning to say, we don't need you. Go home. Okay? So it was that kind of tension, if you will, that existed. And you need to also, you know, sort of understand that LCLC, SNCC staff lived together in a lot of things in Selma at the Freedom House. It was LCLC staff and SNCC staff. To give you an example, I went home to visit my mother, and I was walking, and I got almost home, and the FBI picked me up. You know why they picked me up? Because Douglas Carmichael lived in the Freedom House that I lived. I said, I have nothing to say to you. He was my roommate. That's all I can say. So, you know, you have that kind of stuff. And when you look at the Selma to Montgomery March, you had John Lewis and Jose Bellows, but you also had SNCC folks in Selma. You had Sutton Clark, and after a little while, LCLC began to go into Lowndes County. Sasha McClough and I went, and Jonathan Daniel stayed in Selma but went to Lowndes County to have registered people to vote, and he was shot and killed because he was with a young black girl. The bullet was not intended for him. The bullet was intended for her. And Jonathan Daniel took the bullet that was intended for her. So there was a lot of leadership across the board. And as Bruce sort of indicated, there was a lot of local leaders who put everything on the line. People in Lowndes County was checked off the land, and they lived in tents. So people sacrificed a lot, and especially those people who allowed us to live in their home. Smiley was talking about his experience. I was assigned to Pickens County, and this family decided that we could stay in their house. The city officials heard about it, and the Klan began to ride the street and put out information that if we didn't leave, they was going to burn this family house down. Like Smiley, and nobody would take us out of the Pickens County. People was afraid to even drive us out of the county. We literally had to run through fields in order to get away with our lives and make it to Green County. So we forget about those local folks who put it on the line, who had to stay there. We walked in, we marched, we did the Selma Memorial March. But what did SCLC staff do? We left. But those local folks were still there. Those people who were head of plantation in Lowndes County, they were still there. So you witnessed some of the stuff that took place. But that's, again, is what leadership is all about.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize, so, you know, we celebrated the 50 years of voting rights in March this year. But I just want to share with you, because sometimes history misleads you. It was a group, and you probably haven't heard of it, called the Courageous Eight. The Courageous Eight was a group of local black leaders in Selma that invited Dr. King in. And what happened was that SNCC had been there, they did a lot of work, they did a lot of groundwork. But the local leader said, well, if we bring Dr. King in, we can get more attention, we get more publicity. So they invited Dr. King in, and Dr. King sent in one of the best field organizers that I can ever imagine in the world, Jose Williams. See, sometimes we misled that Jose put yourself and the Montgomery March together. Jose Williams is not mentioned too much about that march. He put that march together. Jose was the best organizer that I ever seen. I think Jose could organize anything. By the time Jose gets to talking to you, well, you're ready to go. He know how to fire you up. You should know that because of school. When you left that training, you were fired up to go, to die, do whatever you have to do. Jose taught me everything I knew. I think I'm a great organizer. And we can never forget that. We can never forget that even with Dr. King, before Dr. King went into a city, Jose Williams went in there. You know, sometimes you know when you plant a garden. You had to go in there and plow up the soil, soften the soil. Whole day we're going there and soften the soil. That's why you, that's why John and everyone on the, in this room, that's why we went out. We was planting seeds under the leadership of Dr. Jose Williams. By the way, we all call him Jose. But everything I do, every now and then when I work on campaigns, I think about Jose Williams. I mean, I'll never be as good as him, but I learned a lot from him. So when we look at the Selma to Montgomery March, Jose Wheaton was the organizer of that march. And all the other local group leadership that he invited them in, during that march, he wanted someone to represent all organizations. If you see pictures of that march, you got Albert Turner, you got Jose Wheaton, you got John Lewis.
And Richard Smiley.
I wouldn't believe you. I was about the 18th person in the line. When I got across that bridge, I looked across and I said, I'm too close. But it's a commitment. It's a commitment. We can never forget Jose Williams. Jose was a passion. Had a passion. Let me tell you, we haven't talked about that. Jose served in the army. Had a Purple Heart. Came out in Savannah, Georgia, tried to drink water out of a white water fountain. He was beat down. That motivated Jose Williams that he'd be rather be dead and then go through this again. This is the man we celebrate. This is the man we give tribute to. This is the man that led us into battle. For Maurice Brown. This is the man that watched over him and got in trouble. He would come and he'll send someone, he'll send JT, or he will send her, he'd come himself. This is the man that we show in tribute to. This is the man that gave us the leadership. He really the cause of all of us here today. Because of what Jose did. And one of the things I would like to say, before we end the conference, I want to know, where do we go from here? When we leave here, are we going with more ammunition? Are we going? Are we going to be excited about going back out there? What are we going to do? Some of us think we're too old to do anything. We might not can do what we used to do, but we can do something. And I was telling someone in the group the other day that we don't have to look that far to do nothing. Look in your community. Look at your next door neighbor. Look at the job that you're still working. I'm an adjunct professor at this community college. I keep voting alive. My student is not a political science class, but they know about Selma. They know that we died. And we died for the right to vote. And one thing I always do in my class, I let my student know that we weren't all blacks. I let them know about the school. I let them know that 4,500 white students came down from all over the country to register people to give up their lives for the right to vote. When we leave here, we got to leave here with something. We just can't leave here like we came. Some of us came with questions, what am I going to do next? What am I going to do? And that's something I want you to think about. Thank you.
All right. It's your turn. It's your turn to ask questions, comments.
whatever.
So I will walk around with the mic so we can all hear you.
So, Harry Boyd, I was a field secretary in 1963 and 1964 and 1965. So I just had two comments and other people to lift up. One is in my experience, the brilliant organizer was Byard Rustin, who hasn't been mentioned much. Tutor, mentor of Martin Luther King and nonviolence, probably did the most to bring nonviolence into the movement. Co-founder of CORE, went down to Montgomery right at the beginning and gave orders of Ethel Randolph and gave King a crash course in organizing and nonviolence. And so, Bruce, I agree with you about nonviolence, but Rustin also saw nonviolence as a strategic way of thinking to win over the middle of America. So the March on Washington was framed as a way to win over the middle. A third of the country was on our side, a third of the country was against us. So that led the challenge of winning over the middle, and young people do not know that lesson today, that strategic lesson. They don't know about winning over the middle, and that has to be communicated. Because we got a lot of people who think you polarize and you win. Well, you don't win if you're progressive and you polarize. You got to win over the middle. The second group that really had a tremendous impact on me, the strongest, were the women, especially, who created the Citizenship Education Program of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So Ella Baker, Septimer Clark, Dorothy Cotton, and there was a discipline. I agree with you. There was a discipline of leadership and local leadership, but that was developed. That just didn't happen. It was developed through thousands and thousands of people who basically went through the citizenship education program and developed a sense of empowerment, of dignity, of largeness of spirit, of how do you work with people you may not like and you don't. They're not your buddies. There was a beloved community, but there were a lot of people who would rather not be in the beloved with. And King assigned me out of that experience to, as I was working with the citizenship education, to organize for whites. Well, that was part of Rustin's strategy to win over the middle, and people who were seen as against us, but as Rustin thought, he saw they were oppressed, and we might be able to reach them, and we had success in that. So I want to lift up again Rustin on the one hand, and the great women who believe in people's empowerment, but you have to work for people's empowerment. It doesn't just happen.
Hi. Because you mentioned great women, I want to ask a question, so I put it out there. There's a woman's name who has not... Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Philip Brown. I'm Executive Director of Gateway Education Foundation, my dad's a nonprofit. We own the home of Miss Amelia Boynton and turning that into a museum to honor those and Selma who did so much, which includes you. That's a name that I have not heard much of. I know I have been speaking the name of Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson since I've been here. My understanding of that story. Because I was not there. At the time, I was 12 and in San Diego, California, angry and upset and not really knowing what to do and how to do, and not realizing how much my dad was involved in the movement at the time. But my question and thought is, when you mentioned the women of the movement, and I heard the gentleman speak about Selma and how that was organized, my understanding is Mr. Bernard Lafayette went in and organized the children, and he was there years before, at least a few years before, 65, and organized the children, and what's on the DVD, the true story, you hear the children talking about how they felt because they heard their parents saying that they would be free once they got the vote. The children that were 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15, and went to jail day after day, saw that as a way of freeing their parents. And I don't hear much mention of that, and I know, looking at the movie, Selma, they don't really share and show you the power of our children. And when the gentleman admonished us, what are we going to do? We have to find a way to pass the torch, or pass the embers that still are burning within you, that you took into the South, and you ignited those communities. We have to touch our children with that spark. They are ready. They are ready, but they need your guidance. So my question and thought is on the limit. Mr. Vivian Boynton.
Yeah, I just want to respond. I was one of those 15, 16 years old and during that time. Bernard, it came to Selma in 1962. We was marching for many things. We haven't seen in downtown Selma and called a drugstore. We was picketing those stores that wasn't hiring black folks. We picked and went to jail every day. And you know, I always tell people, it was the Bloody Sunday was like a big point, but preparation. That we went to jail every day, we got beat, we got cattle prodded, they sent us to Camp Selma. They wouldn't put us in regular jails. They put us in Camp Selma, and what they would do, they'd take out all the beds. They put a tub of water, one nipple. And I remember one night, they called all this about 200 females and about 200 males. They called us all out and made us stand up with our chins on each other's back. And they had a big heater. And they made them find that heater till it looked like that heater was going to melt. People started falling out. When they fell out, the deputy would drag them back in on that cold floor. People caught pneumonia. I was one of those. And like I was saying, that Ms. Boynton was the leader of the Courageous Eight. She was the leader with Mr. Gillespie, Reverend Anderson, and Reverend Hunter. That group got together because even Jim Clark, the sheriff of Selma, Alabama, didn't want them to meet. He threatened them if they met in their house, they was going to be arrested. I don't want to take anything from Bernard Lafayette. They organized, but like I was saying, the Courageous Eight said, look, let's take it to another level. And they invited Dr. King in. Yeah, I was one of those. I went to that, I ended up going to jail at that armory that they got. When they couldn't, when we filled up all the jails, they would put us in the armory. It was a movement. What happened was that the older people would go down to the courthouse to register to vote, and someone would let us know when they go to jail, we would fill up the jail. I understand we used to sing that song, we sang that we ain't gonna let nobody turn us around. But one of the things I want to comment, if nonviolent wasn't what we were preaching and teaching and believing in, you wouldn't be here today. You wouldn't have came to the South that we were burning, and you wouldn't have came, you wouldn't have been here. Some of you parents didn't want you to come anyway. some of you guys haven't had a good relationship with your parents, and it's been 50 years since you came to South. So I agree with you. We had to pass the torch. But I'm just saying that young people's now have a whole different agenda. We try to pass the torch. They don't want to listen to history. They don't want to know how we got over to Jordan. We got over to Jordan preaching love.
Thank you. I just want to follow up briefly with one comment about Mrs. Boynton and Bernard Lafayette. It wasn't in the movie Selma, but a crucial breakthrough in the Selma story. It was illegal for black people to have a mass meeting and talk about freedom in Selma.
Yeah.
And I mentioned earlier, and when I spoke earlier, I talked about audacity. When Mrs. Boynton's husband passed, I believe it was in the latter part of 1963, Mrs. Boynton and Bernard and the other people who referred to as the Courageous Eight came up with an audacious plan to break the barrier against having a mass meeting. They called for a funeral service at Tabernacle Baptist Church. And they said, we're going to have a service for Mr. Boynton. And everybody who came to that service knew it was going to be a freedom meeting. And Sheriff Clark knew it was going to be a freedom meeting. And it was surrounded by the police. And people came right through the police under the pretext that it was a funeral service. And that was the first mass meeting that preached freedom in Selma, Alabama, that Mrs. Boynton and Bernard and the others organized. That was the audacity of finding a creative way to break through. Now, we talk about us as elders. What is our role? I'll tell you right now, I'm too old to march. I ain't gonna do it. I have a hard time getting from here to the room. But one thing that we can tell and work with the young people on is that part of our role, I think, is to tell people that victories have been won. Because if you only focus on what's wrong, then people are going to say, well, Dr. King was 50 years ago, all this stuff, and if things are worse now than they were then it's hopeless, and that the only thing I can do is get what I can for me and mine. So we need to communicate that, yes, things are wrong and need to be changed, but we, your parents and your grandparents, won victories, and because we won victories, you can win victories. Where's the mic?
My name is Jason Kent. I joke with my friends that I'm a love child of that era, multiracial, born in 1972, here with my father. What I want to say is, on behalf of my generation, that's only heard the stories from my mother and my father, and grew up with the miseducation and misrepresentation of what you all went through, is that I am inspired by all of you. I don't want you to leave this weekend without being thanked, without being congratulated, without being appreciated.
This is that one breakout session. You left tremors and vibrations in me. Just with your courage, not really doing it to get any kind of credit. Just doing it because it was the right thing to do. I can tell you that I do this work, poverty advocacy, young people's mentoring, at-risk young people's mentoring, and so I don't want you to get discouraged when you see the organization go on TV and people are using violence and resorting back to things that didn't work. I want you to be encouraged to write letters to those organizations. Tell your story, be it, you know, Facebook, whatever access you have, while you're still here and you're still a witness to what worked, tell that story because it's strong, it's powerful, and inspiring, and young people will listen when they start getting the real story. They're not being educated with the real story. A lot of them are being educated to think that everybody supported Dr. King all along, president included. A lot of people are being told that, you know, you folks weren't there as students, sometimes younger than college age, making huge sacrifices. I don't have much more to say. It's just thank you.
I'd just like to respond to that briefly. And Pike County, where I work, we had a 16-year-old white girl from Alabama now who worked with us. She put it all on the line. And it was our responsibility to protect her. Dan Harrell brought her in. And he will move her every week and a half so that she wouldn't be identified as being from Alabama. And that was his way of attacking her by moving her from spot to spot so they couldn't focus in on her. So you're right. Young people played a crucial role in the movement. And
hi, yeah, I'm Arkansas, and everything everybody says, brings up a memory and a connection. I'll spend 20 seconds showing one. Stokely Carmichael and Byard Rustin both conspired to eventually get me out of jail when I was being tortured in Mobile at the end of 65. And Ms. Boynton, I had only been in Selma maybe about a week in January of 65. And Jim Battle grabs me and says, "Arkansas, come with me." And I didn't know where we were going. We wind up in Ms. Boynton's living room. Ralph Abernathy was there. Jim Foreman was there. Jim Farmer was there. And Dick Gregory was there, and he was a big man then. He weighed about 290 pounds. Now he's half that size. And they were discussing strategy, and I've only been in the movement a week. It's like, I didn't know nothing. I was absolutely overwhelmed. But so I remember nothing about what took place. But boy, what a valuable presence. Let me give you one Hosea story that nobody knows who wasn't there. It's the night after they shot Jimmie Lee Jackson in Marion. That was a Thursday night. So Friday night, we had a mass meeting in Selma. And, you know, Friday, all of my boys are out, they're playing basketball, and then they finish, and they want to have some action. So that was a Friday night in Selma. And it was raining, and we met all day, and we decided it's not majority, it's you vote with your feet. If you got courage to join in this march, we're going to challenge Governor Wallace's ban on night marches. And Hosea was leading us. He didn't speak to motivate us, but he was part of the meeting. And when we came out, Hosea was in front. I was right behind him. And we start down the steps of Brown Chapel Church. And it was raining, medium rain. And Wilson Baker, Public Safety Commissioner, the good guy with the bad guys. All right. He's got his 14-man police force there. They got their clubs at parade rest. And he says, "Hosea, take your people back into the church." And Hosea said, "But Mr. Baker, we got the right to march. It ain't constitutional and stuff." And Wilson Baker says, Hosea, Hosea, look behind me. And we look behind him in the dark, in the rain. It's about 30 white men lined up on horses with rifles in their hands. And right behind them was about 6 pickup trucks with about 6 or 8 white men in the back of each truck carrying rifles. And Wilson Baker says, and I could see the tears pouring down his eyes. And Wilson Baker says, Hosea, look behind me. I cannot control these men. Please, take your people back into the church. And Hosea says, but Mr. Baker, it wasn't good. And you know, no, listen. Baker very gently grabs him, puts him in his police car. And we're standing there. There was about 80 of us who had decided to try this march. And we're standing there. We don't have any leadership. It looked like a pretty good idea to go back into the church. And within a minute or so, we dispersed back into the church. And Baker let Hosea go. And I want to say, in my whole life, such a demonstration of both courage and wisdom that took place at that moment and maybe saved the country. There were probably 100 times in the movement where any more step could have exploded the whole country. That night would have started the race war. Half a minute, I'll finish. That night would have started the race war. They would have killed us. And we learned later on that Al Lingo, who had just beat us all up in Marion the night before and shot Jimmy, he was down at the courthouse with the state troopers, ready to mop up after they had a massacre. So, Hosea Williams' courage, and strangely enough, Wilson Baker's wisdom, got us through that night alive and saved us from the race war. Thank you.
Terrible.
My name is Nancy Maddox, and I'm from Grenada, Mississippi. Originally, I'm an Atlantan now. However, the reason why I wanted to speak is because there's another group of ladies that are never talked about, and that's the SCLC staff. Dr. King didn't go any place that Durham MacDonald didn't go. Reverend Bennett's secretary, Carl Barris's secretary, all of the ladies who work at SCLC are due to be appreciated and definitely mentioned. The receptionist, Claudette Matthews, was at SCLC for almost 30 years, and nobody knows that. Now, you'll see her name in the list of those departed, but Claudette was at SCLC into the 90s. So I just wanted to remind everybody that those of us who had an opportunity to work in the office, we weren't specialists. We were everything. I learned how to research from Carl Ferris. I learned about organizing chapters of SCLC. Yeah, Reverend Rogers, who also was killed in an accident on the way to Alabama, to Tuscaloosa, I believe. I learned how to crop pictures from Gene Jackson, who was the secretary to Tom Offenberger. I learned to be patient when watching Hockey Kleinfeld. I didn't really know what he was doing, but he was that far above me. But the reason that I want to speak also is because I want Jill Freeman to know that she was one of those trees by the side of the water to me. She was the first white girl I really ever got a chance to be around first. And when she left Grenada, I knew that she left because Jose was afraid for her. I didn't know everything. Because I wasn't privileged to that kind of information. But the fact is that without computers, any time I could find anything about the women's movement, I looked for Jill's name. I have been talking about Jill to my children for 50 years. She has no idea how much I admire her. And I want everybody to know that I admire her so much. and I looked forward to seeing her so much. And I thank you all.
One more question, and then we have to give it out. Tara. Let her ask her. She's been having her hand for 10 minutes.
He was up front, sorry. And I told them to just put her down. So both of them, sir. All right. So much pressure.
Yeah, I know. What was your question?
Hi, I'm Kathy. I worked in Southampton County, Virginia. The week of orientation is so strong in my memory. And a particular person, and I think he was mentioned earlier, has remained in my memory. He was, every time he opened his mouth, I was mesmerized by what he said, and that is Bayard Rustin. I was talking about him with somebody earlier, and we called him elegant. He was an elegant person. But he spoke reality. And I also know he was a gay man. And I'm wondering, 50 years ago, that was an issue for many people. And I'm wondering if in the movement, if that was an issue.
Oh, yeah.
It was.
Oh, yeah.
It was.
Big issue.
But Brian was big enough. And Dr. King was wise enough to say to us, that's it. And that's the way we treated him with respect and dignity that he deserved. But it was. All right, thank
well,
you guys.
Can I say something? I want the other younger person in here to have words without me being able to say thank you. So I would just like to say that, you know, I didn't have the privilege of growing up with a parent that was in the movement. And I didn't learn about civil rights history until I was in college. And I had to write a paper. And I was like, they gave us all these options. So I was like, I'm black. I'm about to write something on the civil rights movement. You know, not even knowing. And when I read this book, about the civil rights movement, I was embarrassed because I didn't know. And I will be honest and confess to you that I didn't vote when I was 18. You know, it wasn't convenient because I didn't understand the sacrifices that was made. And so after I read that book, I just kind of like had an evolution about, you know, of my awareness about making a difference. So I'm trying not to cry, but I'm just so touched to be here. Yeah. The conversations and the words of wisdom, like, you know, that is a message, you know, my Pat mother said, you know, the plaid, like, you have to win the middle. Like, that's a seminar within itself. You know, it's so much richness there in all the words that the panelists have spoken. And so I want to say thank you, that some people are going to not know it now, but they're going to be late on it. And I just want to, you know, ask God to use me and, you know, all this information to really just make a difference. So I want to say thank you from a Generation Xer. So that's it. And so I have to give the mic up.
I'm Steve Press. I'm in Orangeburg, South Carolina. I want to comment just briefly about the idea of reaching out to younger people. When I was maybe 14 or 15, it was the era of the Woolworth lunch counters being segregated and around the country, boycotts and pickets, et cetera, et cetera. I grew up in an all-white suburb on Long Island. However, Long Island was not all-white. There was an act of CORE chapters, and CORE went recruited high school students, possibly even junior high school students, but to join picket lines of local Woolworths, which were not segregated, but were part of the chain, and we took the action. I was a kid. I was fortunate. I was 15. So when SCOPE came along when I was 18, in a way, it was a natural progression. You know, it was the next thing for me to do. because they started as a child. And my own kids, who are now, the twins, are now 40. I never gave them political lectures, but I, you know, as their dad, I tell them about myself and things I did, including SCOPE, including other things. And they've carried on the torch. In high school, there was, I don't know if this was a national thing or just in high school, their high school, but there was something called SEED, S-E-E-D, Students Educating Each Other About Discrimination. Well, I didn't even know about it until they told me, oh, yeah, we're organizing a SEED group here in our high school. And that's what they did. They're continuing now as adults in their own way, kind of continuing the struggle. And you've got to keep the young people, you've got to reach the young people, and keep them involved, and they will pass the torch on to their young people when they come along. Thank you.
I want to say something about the real heroes and heroines in Selma. When the march was over, Bill Stein, with whom I worked making the recordings that we would send over the radio and television stations from what was going on. And for instance, one of those we sent to the world was the telephone call where we heard that the Oval of Lutzow had been shot. After the march was over, we interviewed about 30 of the people who were able to march through Lowndes County. I don't know if you know that, but only 300 people were allowed to march through Lowndes County, where the most lynchings were, and others were killed. So out of these 300 people, we interviewed a number of them. And there's one interview I would like to be a part of, because it tells about the general that did that globally. There's one young lady, and she said, well, on the march, when the first night, the heaters went out in the tents, we had to sleep cold. And the next day, we marched, and my feet, there were so many blisters, we went to the first aid station, and the nurse said, you're not going to keep going with all those blisters. She says, they only hurt when I stop. And when I marched through Mountains County, those people, there were so many, I just prayed to God to help me pick my feet up and put them down. And then when I got into Montgomery, I had the biggest flag there, and I was so proud. I said, what's going to happen now? All these white folks, other people will come down for the march, go back home, and you're going to have to go on here without them. She said, well, the Negro has to keep going on here. I can't speak for everybody in Selma, but I am not afraid. I said, and furthermore, all these white folks, I never hated white folks, and I was having around for security. It was good for me. But she said, yeah. She said, and what are you going to do now? She said, I'm not afraid. We all have to die one day or another. And I think it's a good idea if you die for something and not for nothing. And I think that this is a good reason for dying. I think we've all said at one time or another, this is something worth dying for. But how many of us have ever said this with a conviction of this young girl who is on her way to the third civil rights funeral? in less than one month. So the real heroes, I just want to thank.